This is Audible.
Belisarius Call, The Great Work, by Guy Haley. Read by John Banks. Fed on stars of dying light, broken now and scattered far, for sins of violence and deceit, soul greed, brought down those bright, enduring beings more luminous than we. Numinous, who saw worlds born and burn, made monsters by their greed, and by their art making more, are banished by steel children. Defeated, undefeated, yet asunder. Warnings for seer and shepherd seen, beware. Soul hunger has no sating. What rests awakens. They wait. They stir. They starve. These gods that sleep and dream. Eldari lay of unknown origin. Translation by Rolof Utzmartinekwa of Dane. Executed 879 M39. Chapter 1. Borrowed Time. Circa 10,000 years ago, Ezekiel Sedaine was dying. There was a time when he stood tall among men, as much a physical as an intellectual giant, but those days were done. He was old. He was at the end. His 7-foot frame had shrunken in, his spine curled with calcium loss. His hands were knotted with arthritis. His skin was slack, flowing around brittle bones like draped cloth. His lustrous black hair had turned as fine and white as the silk of a spider's nest. It spread around his head on the pillow, as if it, like his skin, had been laid there, and if he stood, if he had been capable of standing, he would have left it behind, as a cloud of down. Sedaine's life had lasted longer than any child of terror had a right to expect, but all things are finite, and his existence was coming to a close. Human beings are aware of their mortality, yet they deny it to the very last. Sedaine regarded his intelligence to be in excess of most others. He believed he was free of the delusions that ruled the mind to reason's detriment, yet now he succumbed. He could scarcely believe death was knocking at his door. This cannot be happening to me, he thought. But it was. Sedaine had come from nothing to become one of the greatest scientists of his age. Despite his failing body, his mind was sharp, his insight clear. In numb amazement, he insisted he felt young in his soul. The ravages of age on his body gave the lie to that. He appeared in many respects like a corpse. Lips drew back from yellow teeth made long by the recession of dark gums. No matter how fast his thoughts raced, his body barely moved. His chest trembled with the bird flutter of his heart. Every inhalation was a bellows wheeze. But he was not dead yet. The breaths kept coming, and when the door to his bedchamber creaked wide, his eyelids flickered open, and his eyes, which were strikingly moist in the dry valleys of his parchment skin, swiveled to fix themselves upon his visitor.
"The Altrix Herminia," he wheezed.
His top lip stuck to his teeth for want of saliva, spoiling his smile. He was drying up from the inside out, like a spice pod left out to desiccate in the sun. Soon every drop of life would be wrung out of him, and there would only be an arid husk left. Then there would not even be that. The Altrix came forwards with a rustle of layered, soft plastic clothing. Upon her breast pocket she wore a caduceus in red and white that contrasted with the pale green of her dress. The uniform was formal and tightly laced, a symbol binding her to her duty. But though her garments were restrictive, she moved with easy grace that suggested athletic, if not dangerous, power. "My Lord Director," she said, dipping her head respectfully. The sharp curve of her fringe swung neatly over her eyes.
"Your arrival pleases me."
Sedaine's head moved feebly to the side so he could follow her approach. The appetites of a younger man tormented him.
"Age does not agree with me,"
he said. He was tiring, his breath rasping harder. He was a machine, close to shutdown. He looked to the Altrix's face, then at the fat syringe she carried in her hand.
The time is close.
Each word was an individual effort. Each syllable required him to assign it a painful breath. Such care and attention his words received now, when once they were spent so carelessly. It is, my lord, said the Altrix. You are dying. Sedaine gave a death's head grin.
I can always trust you to dress things up prettily for me, he said. How goes the search?
I have identified 7 possible candidates, all acolytes of Diakomis. Recovery missions are outbound.
Then administer the last of the elixir. I want to walk and move again. I've been confined here too long.
You are sure?
He nodded his head painfully.
You brought it. You knew what I would say.
This is the last, she said.
Marbled, opaque, silvery liquid that moved to currents of its own filled the glass cylinder.
The Adarnians are gone, the last rendered down. Their world is empty. Once I inject this dose, there will be no more. I am sorry.
The Adarnian race was decreed harmless during the Great Crusade and allowed to live under an imperial protectorate. It had not prevented them being harvested to extinction. Unluckily for them, their body chemistry had miraculous effects on the human organism.
A shame. I never...
He swallowed twice, trying to summon enough spit to lubricate his creaking larynx.
Learned how to synthesize it,
he said in a breathless rush.
Are you certain that now is the time, my lord? We could delay a few days. There is sufficient here to return you to health for a few months, no more. It may be better to wait until a candidate has been selected and returned to Terra.
He closed his eyes.
No. Do it. Now.
He was too weak to hold out his arm, so Herminia pulled it gently from under the covers, fetched a stirrup rest, and strapped the limb in place. The veins in the crook of his elbow were ruined by repeated injection, and it took an amount of coaxing to find a suitable place for the needle. The drug had to be administered directly into the bloodstream in large amounts. Pneumatic injection or skin absorption would not do. Adarnian elixir was the last resort of dying men when all other rejuvenants failed. It came with many prices, not least the atrocity of its making. The elixir was illegal, its use punishable by death. Sedaine didn't care about the Xenos or the law, but there were other more immediate costs. Firstly, when the elixir's positive effects were exhausted, the user returned to a worse state than before. Every dose brought the certainty of hurried deterioration. This last dose would kill him. Secondly, there was pain.
Are you ready? She said.
He blinked his assent. She set the needle to his arm. She had no need to tell him it would hurt. The beasting of the needle piercing his flesh made him gasp. The real pain came with the plunger's depression. Health-giving poison pressed from the organs of sentient beings flooded his system, and with it came a fire that scoured age back with its heat, reforging frayed genes and kick-starting the machineries of life. Stolen youth ran riot through his body. Ezekiel Sedaine screamed. Chapter 2. The Egidian Orbital. Now. Glittering debris surrounded the corpse of the planet. Grey as old bone, drier than dust, a shroud of shining particulates gathered solemnly around the corpse as it proceeded about the sun. The track the world ran was the most amenable to life, and yet life was absent entirely. The broken remains of a single void station hung at equatorial high anchor, its decaying orbit recently stabilized. The soft shine of atmospheric shields closing the breaches in one section was just visible against the sun's glare. 3 ships occupied the orbital's near space. Between the station and the world was a light cruiser bearing rich heraldry of yellow and black. Crossed scythes of gold on a sable background adorned its stern shield plates. In the glare of the sun, the scars all over its hull were starkly visible. The scrollwork upon its hammerhead prow bore the name Sterope, one of the 10 legendary steeds of Sotha. Closest to the orbital was a small vessel of the Mechanicus tech priests. Much of it was bare metal, the rest painted in the rich reds of Mars. It had no name displayed, but several identification plates bore the same number string, 01010. Small in size, it was nevertheless packed with manufacturing facilities and dock points, and a constant stream of drone craft passed between the ship and the station. The vessel furthest out was a larger Space Marine strike cruiser of new design, fresh from the shipyard, and free of damage or alterations to its original plan. Its deep blue livery was unmarred, the horned Ultima displayed in many places remaining crisply white. It was a young, yet fierce ship, and was named the Lord of Vespeta, for it bore the ruler of that world as he travelled throughout his kingdom. A hangar door opened in the side of the Lord of Vespeta. A single gunship emerged. Exhaust stabbing from the engines made a blade of blue plasma fire, and the ship's hull shone as bright as a jeweled hilt, so that it resembled a sword thrown handle first to a beleaguered warrior battling a monster. But the weapon came too late. The monster had triumphed. The world was dead. So did Decimus Felix, Tetrarch of Ultramar, come to survey the ruin of his domain.
"A tight fit," said Daedalus.
The tech marine altered the ship's path with minute adjustments to the flight sticks. Felix looked out through the armored glass blister. The cockpit was set high back above the transport bays, and the ceiling passed within inches of his face, close enough that he could examine the damage to the metal and name the bioweapons responsible. Only Daedalus's skill saw the Overlord squeeze into the hangar. His left hand moved swiftly over the ship's array of buttons. Jets fringed the blocky double hull with bursts of light and vapor in response.
"This is not ideal," said Felix.
"I've landed in tighter spaces, my lord," said Daedalus, tense with concentration. "Not many, I'll admit."
Daedalus's crew consisted of a further Primaris Marine in the red of the forge and 3 chapter serfs. They were far too preoccupied with landing to speak to the Tetrarch, but peered at their instruments nervously. Tronchus, the tech marine co-pilot, was immobile. Only the tiny movements of his hands as he corrected Daedalus's few errors showed that a living being occupied his armor. Proximity alarms trilled from several quarters. The prow lights hit a solid wall.
"Emperor's will, this is getting worse," Daedalus said.
The landing bay had suffered catastrophic damage. Efforts to patch it up had shrunk its space by half. A wall of plasteel plating fixed in place with metallic foams divided the bay. Bracing girders holding the wall upright angled into the hangar, making Daedalus's task all the more difficult.
"Nearly got it," the pilot said, more to himself than to anyone else.
Felix watched ruptured metal pass by. The Ejida had possessed many landing decks. The monsters of High Fleet Kraken had wrecked them all as they boarded. Only this smaller docking portal had been returned to operational use. The Overlord's power core whined up and down as Tronchus adjusted the energy flow in preparation for landing. The ship swayed. Tronchus looked at the pilot.
"That's not my fault," Daedalus said to his unspoken rebuke. "Grav plating's no good in here," he grumbled. "Nothing's good in here. Tronchus, run landing sequence. This is the best position we're going to get."
Felix's earbeads clicked. Daedalus had opened an unencrypted Vox channel.
"Sergeant Comminus," Daedalus said, "I'm setting down."
"Ready. Open the forward hatches,"
Comminus voxed back.
"Depressurizing holds. There's no atmosphere. I'm sure you've got your helmets on."
"I need not remind you. I find your levity irritating, Daedalus."
"He's no fun, that one,"
said Daedalus, making sure Comminus heard before he shut the channel.
"He serves well," said Felix.
"He could smile while he was doing it," said Daedalus. "Life does not all have to be drill and duty, not even for us."
The atmospheric retention field was out, leaving the hangar open to space. Daedalus joggled the flight sticks against the outrush of air expelled from the twin passenger compartments. The ramps opened as the vessel's engines gave out one last burst. The starboard wing squealed noisily down the partition wall, causing Felix to grit his teeth.
"I said it was tight," Daedalus muttered.
Before the Overlord settled onto its landing claws, 8 space marines ran out, bolt rifles at the ready, and took up guard at various points of the hangar. Each wore Mark 10 intercessor pattern power armor in differing heraldries, but all were united by their richly decorated left pauldrons, where the sigil of the Tetrarch of Vespeta was displayed on golden plating. Commodus was more obvious for his manner than the bright red and white war gear he wore, or his sergeant's insignia. He stood in front of the Overlord's nose, directing Felix's bodyguard with a flurry of battle sign, his bolt rifle held upright. The engines wheezed. The ship sank down on its hydraulics and ceased moving.
"That's it. We're in," Dalis said.
Tronchus clicked a dozen buttons. The serfs visibly relaxed and began post-flight checks. The power plant quieted to a hum. Dalis's armor sighed as it disconnected from the umbilicus set into the back of the seat. The armor was heavy on him without power, but he turned round naturally enough and angled his helm to look up at Felix.
"Welcome to the Ajida Orbital, my lord. Welcome to Sotha."
They left the hangar, Commodus first. The sergeant insisted on taking point himself, as he did every time the Tetrarch ventured out from the Regia Tetrarchia on Vespeta. Felix followed his men, the blue of his ultramarine's armor dark in the badly lit station. Felix disliked pomp, but he accepted the bodyguard. Another warrior of his skill might be annoyed by the constant watch and the implication he could not take care of himself. Felix was pragmatic enough to know that being annoyed by his attendants would do nothing to change the fact of their presence, so he did not allow himself to feel anything much about it, and thanked them often for their service. Likewise, Commodus's terse, officious manner failed to irritate him. Felix did his best to follow Lord Gilliman's example in all things, and see a thing for its potential utility, not for how it made him feel. When he did examine those feelings, he resented the constant cosseting his position forced on him. These moments of weakness only strengthened his resolve to behave as Lord Gilliman would wish. The bodyguards and all his many attendants back on Vespeta had purpose, and they must therefore be allowed to fulfill it, and not be hampered nor criticized merely for being. Theoretical, practical, the Ultramarian way served him well. But emotions are disobedient creatures, and he found himself glad that he had only his bodyguard with him. He welcomed the break from his staff. Since being appointed as Tetrarch, one of the 4 lords of Greater Ultramar by Rabute Gilliman, Felix had done his best to visit every sector. This was his first trip this far into the old Sotharan League. His Lord Castellan on Vespeta had pointedly remarked that Felix took his tours to avoid politics. There was perhaps truth in that. Felix turned his attention outwards to the ruin of the orbital. The signs of recent reoccupation grew more obvious as they made their way towards the command hub. Again, his emotions rose up from beneath his conditioning.
"It is strange, the way this makes me feel,"
he said to veteran brother Cadmus, who hailed from the scythes of the Emperor chapter, to whom the station had belonged.
"There is so little evidence of what happened here, but what remains is as clear as a sword cut in ancient bone. While the tale of the attack is only implied, the evidence tells a more poignant story than a bloody corpse would."
They continued down a corridor lit by lumens on poles linked by suspended cable. There was no air and no gravity, so the 11 of them walked with the strange, deliberate gait of warriors with active maglocks.
"I see everywhere the signs of bioweapons. Puncture wounds to the metal, acid burn, the marks of teeth and claws, but no organics remain, all reabsorbed by the Kraken, I assume."
"That is the way of the Xenos, my lord," Cadmus said.
Cadmus was a scythe, but he was also a Primaris marine and had never been to Sotha. His voice was level, if a little distant, leading Felix to suspect he too wrestled with what he felt and what he was supposed to feel.
"You have fought the Tyranids?" Felix asked.
"My chapter makes a point of confronting them where they can," said Cadmus. "I have faced splinters only, the left behind and the lost. Nothing compared to the fleet that devoured Sotha, but deadly nonetheless."
Felix nodded. The effects of the Tyranid weapons had sculpted the metal. Ahead, sunlight streamed through a huge breach in the hull. It was curious that the deck remained level, he thought, without the distortion to the deck plating one could expect from more conventional weaponry. When they drew level with the hull, he saw that the cause of the breach was not a weapon, but partial absorption. The metal had been devoured. The scrapings of tiny teeth were still bright at the edges a century later. "They consume more than organics," said Cadmus, following his lord's gaze. "The Tyranids will take everything."
"Then why not all?" said Felix.
He paused in the breach, and his security detail came to an instant halt, arrayed by order of march in a perfect protective pattern.
"A question for the Archmagos when he gets here," said Cadmus.
Felix nodded.
"If anyone knows, I am sure he will.
Did you serve the scythes of the Emperor long before you joined the Chosen of the Tetrarchy?"
Cadmus stared out into the void. Such blackness in such strong light created an odd velvety effect that appeared unreal, no matter how many times it was seen.
6 years, by the Sotharan date stamp.
Felix knew this. He selected every man for his chosen personally, but he preferred to hear the information from the men himself, when he could. There was no soul in cold data. A commander learned a lot from his warriors by listening to them, even if they only said what could be more easily read. The way they spoke, the way they held themselves, and how they handled particular subjects revealed their innermost thoughts in a way written words did not. Speech revealed a humanity not even Adeptus Astartes' conditioning could blunt.
"I was there on Hamagora. Most of my experience has been fighting the traitors and their demons, my lord. The Xenos are something else."
Cadmus paused to better formulate his words.
"It is impossible to overestimate the hatred my brothers in the chapter hold for the Tyranids. The veterans are fixated, but it affects we Primaris brothers too. It is a contagious hate. It defines us all."
"Then it should be made use of," said Felix.
"I agree," said Cadmus. "Hate is a sharp blade, but there is something else to them that concerns me. A distance to the last few of the original scythes."
Cadmus looked at Felix.
"I apologize, my lord, if I speak out of turn. It is not my place to criticize a man as great as Chapter Master Thracian."
"You will speak as you will, Cadmus," said Felix.
"I understand your reticence, but in the matters of the size of the Emperor, I ask you to be my adviser, and not merely my bodyguard. If anything at all gives you reason to doubt, to pause, you must share it. Not all of the chapters accepted their Primaris brothers easily."
"It is not that," said Cadmus. "We were welcomed as saviours, my lord. We are fated and honoured beyond what our achievements should have earned."
The orbital was spinning slowly. Its motion brought cold, dead Sotha into view. Stripped of life, it shone mirror bright, white as a polished skull.
"Then your worries go deeper."
Cadmus nodded. "There were so few of them left, my lord. A handful. The last of the original scythes are secretive and grim."
"They lost much. I have read what records there are. If we are to be honest, they performed poorly in battle. They bear responsibility for their own near destruction."
"I agree with this, but it is more than shame," said Cadmus.
Again he paused, reluctant to voice his doubts.
"What then?"
prompted Felix.
"I believe they are hiding something, my lord."
Glaring sunshine cut across them quickly as the movement of the station turned the Aegean orbital from the planet, swept past the sun, and plunged them back into gloom. Cadmus's red helm lenses glowed. In the dark, Felix saw the eyes behind them and the silvered effect of retinas glowing under direct laser data writing. As he confessed his human fears, Cadmus looked far from human. That was the fate of the Adeptus Astartes, to remain a man, yet to be divorced from mankind, fighting monsters in the dark.
"I note it well," Felix said, "and I thank you for your counsel, Brother Cadmus."
"Advance," Felix said to the others. "To the central hub. Let us meet these heroes ourselves and judge them as we find them."
His bodyguard moved on, weapons at the ready. The approach to the hub was scarred with bioweaponry discharge and the telltale starburst damage of bolt gun fire. Fighting had been heavy there. Further along, the scars of acid and claw disappeared under fresh plating. A temporary airlock barred the corridor near the command deck, where new wall sections had been welded in place. A servitor on a tracked unit waited, inactive, outside. A pair of tripod-mounted twin plasma sentry guns, painted the red of Mars and stamped with the maker's mark of Belisarius' call, tracked the space marines, their charging coils glowing in readiness. The way was wide and tall, big enough to take the larger dreadnought models, but the airlock was small, enough to admit only one space marine at a time, a temporary measure. A skull mounted at the apex of the arch over the airlock came to life. Ocular sensors at the back of eye sockets glowed with sudden alertness. A fleshless jaw worked around a voxcaster, snapping together so hard that, had there been an atmosphere in the corridor, it would have rattled out a bony percussion.
"State purpose and name,"
a grating machine voice blurted into their helmet vox. Commonus stepped forward.
"Commonus, veteran sergeant, seconded from the Sons of Aurar Chapter Adeptus Astartes, group leader for the Chosen of Vespater, Tetrarchy security unit assigned to Tetrarch Decimus Felix of that world."
"Ranking officer required. Tetrarch Felix will present himself," said the skull. "Stand aside."
Commonus stood his ground until Felix ordered him to step back.
"I am Tetrarch Decimus Androdinus Felix of the Ultramarines, born of Laphis, Lord of Vespater and the Eastern Marches."
Felix data-pulsed his credentials and the seal of his office to the machine.
"Allow us entry."
"A moment,"
the machine said. The lights went out in the skull's eyes. The jaw hung slack.
"Friendly," said Daedalus.
The Techmarine servo arms followed the motions of his hands as he gestured at the plasma guns.
"They are well made, though."
He bent down so that his faceplate was level with the weaponry and moved his head from side to side. The guns tracked his movement.
"Very responsive."
The reactor core spooled up and the coils glowed brighter.
"You take too many risks,"
said Commonus. Daedalus stood.
"Everything I do is weighed against the balance of probability, theoretical and practical, every step of the way. Ultramarian dialectic is a tradition of thought your chapter could do with reinstating. You can't hold it against me if I calculate risk better than you do."
Commonus grunted dismissively. The skull's eyes relit, prompting an instant reaction from the Chosen. Bolt rifles aimed smoothly at the door and emplaced weapons.
"Identity confirmed," said the machine. "Please proceed within, Tetrarch."
The airlock door rolled back. Commonus made to lead, but Felix stepped ahead of him and entered the pressure chamber first. The chamber had been adapted from the corridor and was therefore large enough for all 11 of them. Blast doors of ancient design faced the airlock entrance. They had been repaired, but the great gouges inflicted by Tyranid melee weapons were evident as outlines, filed down and filled though they were. The remains of the turrets that had protected the doorway were boxed in with fresh plates. Around these, too, were the score marks of huge claws. Air rushed into the chamber from a newly installed pipe leading into the command deck. Sound returned to Felix's autosensors. The doors screeched back on buckled tracks. A serious attempt had been made to bring the Ajidan command hub back to a usable state. Besides a supply of air, the gravity plates were operational. Wrecked machinery had been cleared away, and the holes their removal left had been plated over. Little of the original layout was therefore intact. The central dais and the gallery around the room were integral to the structure and remained, again, much patched, but most else was gone, leaving a large, empty space. Seams of bright metal showed where elements had been cut out. Dull plasteel covered the worst damage. Loose plates provided bridges of utility ducts currently open for repairs. Temporary workstations lined one wall, power cables snaking off from them out through a fresh hole cut to allow access to a functional energy conduit. Alcoves around the room housed statues of 10 horses in various states of action. All but one had been damaged in some way. The worst of them had been caved in entirely, turning them into wrinkled bronze sacks with incongruous equine details. They reminded Felix of the abominations of chaos, and he looked away from them. A large section of wall had been torn away. This damage had so far been left untouched, and the breach was closed off by an atmospheric energy screen stretching from one side of the room to the other. On the far side of the field's blue shimmer, void frost glimmered on the ragged deck. 13 space marines waited for the Tetrarch. 5 other beings of human origin occupied the room. 4 were mind-slaved combat servitors, 2 outfitted for close-range gunfights, the other pair pure melee models. The 5th was almost as heavily augmented, but of free will, being an adept of the cult Mechanicus. His humanoid body was entirely made of plasteel, though the face atop the banded neck was of flesh and blood. He wore no protection beyond a calming smile. A number of small subsidiary arms tapped restlessly inside his robes. The majority of the space marines were facing the door in anticipation of Felix's entrance. Those that weren't were in the process of getting up as he entered. They arranged themselves in groups according to friendship, rather than squad, if their markings were anything to go by. The Chosen filed in and faced the scythes of the Emperor. Felix had never seen a bigger difference between 2 groups of loyal space marines. His Primaris marines wore burnished armor with perfect heraldry. The scythe's war gear was scuffed and dinged, the yellow and black applied over mismatched components from differing armor marks. There was an apothecary among them, and a forge master, whose presence was marked out by the better state of his war gear, as much as by his rank marks and red coloration. A lack of uniformity was common in space marine units forced to fight unsupplied for a long time, but the scythes of the Emperor took it to an extreme. 4 of the warriors wore Terminator plate. 3 of these were neatly presented, but the 4th's armor was an ugly mix of different sets, and many elements had been hastily repaired. In a force less desperate, Felix thought, the 4th suit would not have left the armory. Even his own scythe of the Emperor, Cadmus, looked apart from his supposed brethren, despite their shared heraldry. So clean, he appeared like an impostor. Felix was reminded of the Ultramarines' tyrannic war veterans. All of the scythes sported trophies of Xenos bone and chitin in faded shades of crimson and cream. They were individuals. There was no coherency to their unit or their attitude. Some stood to attention, others looked ready for combat. One was insolently slouched. Felix realized that although the chapter had been restored to full strength by the influx of Primaris space marines, what was stood in front of him was the remnants of a dying brotherhood. They were the last. At their head was their master. His armor was hung with more teeth and claws than all the rest, burying his more conventional honors under a savage display. Soft chimes in Felix's helmet informed him that the atmosphere was suitable for breathing, and that the temperature, though frigid, was tolerable. He had barely formed the thought of removing his helm when Commonus privately voxed him.
"I advise you, Tetrarch, to leave your helmet on."
"A meeting like this is best conducted face to face," Felix said aloud.
He lifted his hands to his head, always an awkward motion, thanks to his Boltstorm gauntlet. A further barrier was the cowl common to all Gravis armor, but he had had much practice taking out the helm, and he managed it smoothly. Seals hissed. An inrush of freezing atmosphere replaced the breath-warm air in his power armor. He clasped his helm beneath his arm. His features were strong, but bland in the mass-produced way of many space marines. He had pale brown skin, a last reminder of his homeworld's thin air. A heroic jaw, a nose that echoed Gilliman's, piercing grey eyes and black hair. He would have been handsome, were he fully human, but his features were too much blunted by the process of apotheosis to be so. He wore his intelligence for all to see.
"Do not worry yourself about your master's well-being. I assure you, gentlemen, that the atmospheric shield I and my servants fitted to this orbital functions perfectly," said the tech adept.
"Who are you?" asked Felix.
The adept dipped his head.
"I am Kvo 87. I was sent ahead by the Archmagos to prepare this station for our rendezvous. I apologize that it has not yet been returned to full functionality, but the damage is extensive. Returning the Ajida to its original glory will take time."
"As is evident."
Felix looked at the blue field holding in the air.
"You have done well in such a short period."
Quo 87 dipped his head again.
It will suffice for now. For 10,000 years the Ajida has stood sentinel over Sotha. It will do so again.
If you can achieve that, Magos Quo, then you will have my respect.
One of Felix's tasks was to evaluate the station for repair. Sotha might be dead, but it was still strategically important. Reports had led him to believe the station was irreparable, but what he had seen so far had been promising.
You must be Chapter Master Thracian, said Felix, turning to face the leader of the scythes.
Thracian responded by removing his own helm and showing a scarred, fierce face to the Tetrarch.
I am he, said Thracian.
Burns mottled his left cheek. The eye they crossed was milky white.
I thank you for attending and for giving your permission to use this orbital.
I could not likely refuse one of the Tetrarchs, said Thracian. You speak with the authority of the Primarch.
You have a reputation as a loyal servant of the Emperor. My thanks are genuine.
Thracian shrugged. His patched armor wheezed as it matched his movement.
The galaxy is in turmoil, and Sotha is gone, Thracian said, with obvious emotion.
He looked through the atmospheric field where the planet's bare skull was rising again.
The Primarch himself has given over this portion of the Imperium to you to rule as you see fit. I would not deny you.
Sotha's seas were empty bowls. The denuded continents showed networks of dry water channels and the spidery fractals of mountain ranges. It was like a precise geological model of a world.
Behold the bounty of your realm,
Thracian said bitterly. Sotha's barrenness filled the breach side to side. In the harsh light of the star reflected from the world, the room turned hard monochrome. Every scratch and crack in the ceramite of Thracian's armor was mercilessly illuminated. The colors that disguised the worst of the damage bleached away. The sockets of the skulls adorning his armor were caves of night, staring hungrily at the Tetrarch. Thracian's face was battered, bald, craggy, broken, luminous. The living spirit of the planetary corpse.
This is the extent of your forces?
As requested, I brought no more than my bodyguard. I assume the remainder of your men are aboard your cruiser.
Thracian laughed.
This is the extent of my forces. The Primaris Youngblood sailed the void at Gilliman's behest aboard the heart of Kronos. These few veterans you see here are all that remains of the original scythes of the Emperor. We have business below that is ours alone to undertake.
Cadmus informed me your contingent of original space marines had become small.
Felix frowned.
How did this occur? The most recent Munitorum estimate put your chapter at 2 companies' strength at the time of the Primaris reinforcement.
Those figures are a century out of date, said Thracian. The rest have fallen into shadow.
We are all that remains. When we die, our gene seed will be laid to rest, and the Primaris Marines will take our place. They are the future. Emperor be thanked for the gift of Kaul. We are the past. You brought none of your new warriors with you? Asked Felix.
We welcomed their coming, and honor them, but this mission is not for the new.
The rotation of the platform pivoted shadows across Thracian's features as Sotha crept away.
Sotha is our world.
It never belonged to the children of Kaul. Let them have a fresh beginning as we fade away. It sorrows me that you bring Brother Cadmus to see the source of our shame.
He watched the world rolling past.
The rest of our chapter have no memory of Sotha, and I have no wish to risk the reborn scythes on this expedition into the past. The Emperor's Watch is no place for them, or us, not any longer. What risks do you anticipate?
My warriors have a great deal of experience in fighting the Tyranids, Lord Tetrarch, said Thracian. When they harvest a world, they often leave sentry organisms behind. We surmise this is to inform the hive mind of the return of life. Oftentimes, gene-stealers roost in some number near sites of settlements,
lying in wait to infect those who come to offer aid or to investigate what has happened, Thracian said angrily. They are a perfidious race.
Then we are 24 Adeptus Astartes, with the warriors of the Archmagos to call upon, said Felix. Worlds have fallen to less.
And larger forces have been lost without trace. Thracian pointed at the great disk of the world, picking out a lonely mountain by a dry sea, its feet cloaked by a dead city.
If we overcome the horrors the Kraken will have left behind, the Archmagos wishes to disturb the Pharos. No good can come of that, so yes, risk is the word.
Thracian exhaled heavily. The planet continued on its journey over the breach, half of it past the broken walls by now, and its light dimming. The colour crept back into Thracian's armour.
I offer you the chance to turn back. The 10 steeds of Sotha will ride on for the Emperor. We owe Kaul a great debt for our chapter's resurrection, and so I grant his wish willingly. If he wants to dice with fate, so be it. But as Space Marine to Space Marine, I urge you to go now, Decimus Felix. The heritage of the Scythes of the Emperor is secure.
He smiled grimly.
Who will carry on your legacy if you perish here? Do not enter the mountain.
Felix's eyes narrowed at the warning.
I live to serve. I do not care for legacies. I have fought demons and fallen primarchs at the Lord Gilliman's side, said Felix.
The passing planet relinquished the command deck to Lumen Light.
Nothing daunts me. Nothing can.
Thracian smiled again ruefully, the sort of expression an uncle gives an overly confident nephew. He looked down, and when he looked up again, he was suffused with a chapter master's authority, and when he spoke, his voice rang. Even Felix, who had stood at the right hand of Rabute Gilliman himself, felt the hairs on his neck prickle.
They shall be my finest warriors, Thracian quoted the Emperor. These men who give of themselves to me. Like clay I shall mould them, and in the furnace of war forge them. They will be of iron will and steely muscle. In great armour shall I clad them, and with the mightiest guns will they be armed. They will be untouched by plague or disease. No sickness will blight them.
His voice rose.
They will have tactics, strategies, and machines, so that no foe can best them in battle. They are my bulwark against the Terror. They are the defenders of humanity. They are my Space Marines, and they shall know no fear.
When he finished the quote, all were silent. Thracian's voice dropped.
Fine words, but I know they are not true. I know there are beings a Space Marine cannot best. I am not ashamed to say to you that I have known fear.
Chapter 3. A Debt Repaid. Circa 10,000 years ago.
Belisarius Kaul! I am Belisarius Kaul!
Kaul released the vox button.
Cog and tooth, he swore. It's not working!
Energy flare burned around the small oculus of the Silencia, hiding space in a mix of oily void shield discharge and licks of flame. The ship yawed hard, punched down by kinetic overspill. Friedrich Adam Silip Kvo launched himself out of his own seat and staggered over the heaving deck to Kaul's station.
"What are you doing, Friedrich?" said Kaul. "You'll do yourself an injury. Sit down. You are positing a choice between a bump on the head and imminent atomic dissolution. I know which I prefer."
He slapped Kaul's hands away from the vox controls.
"Let me try." "Get off!"
shouted Kaul.
"Let me try!"
Friedrich snapped back, fussing hopelessly over the buttons, stabbing them until the console's inbuilt hololithic display indicated an open vox channel.
"I just tried that," Kaul snarled. "I'm getting their ident beacon, but nothing else. You don't know as much about intership vox systems as I do. Since when did you know more than me about anything?" "Since now," said Friedrich.
He pulled a data tether from a socket in his wrist and plugged it into the console. Call had to admit he was mildly impressed by Friedrich's ability to remain upright while the ship bounced under fire.
"Will you please, please, please stop firing on us?" said Friedrich.
"I don't think pleading is going to work, Friedrich," said Call. "They're not responding."
"But the channel's open," said Friedrich.
Another hit had the Silencia drop alarmingly. Tesla, the bridge's third occupant, stood maglocked to the deck, unmoved by the danger they were in. His cyborg brain, expertly reconstructed by Call, was incapable of emotion. His slack face showed nothing but idiot disinterest. The same could not be said of the tech priests. They shouted in panic as a hard hit slammed at the ship. The tortured shriek of void generators resounded up the corridors. Friedrich grabbed at Call to stop himself falling down, prompting an undignified flurry of robed limbs as Call shoved him off.
"One more impact like that, and the shields will be down, and then we'll be dead," said Call.
"But this is Riser. Riser is on our side still, isn't it?" said Friedrich plaintively.
A loud shrieking warble screamed up the ship from the generatorium.
"Have you got the Vox working?" shouted Call.
"What?"
"The Vox! The Vox! The all-knowing blessed machine god's Vox meter!" yelled Call. "Does it work? You're plugged into the thrice malfunctioning thing!"
"Yes! No!
I don't know!"
said Friedrich, his augmetic eye flashing with rapid data inload.
"The machine spirits say we lost our comms mast when we fled Scepter Station. That's why they're not responding." "Brilliant!" growled Call. "My turn. I'll try redirecting the signal through the mag deflector. We're at close enough range if I modulate them properly."
Via the hard lines linking him to the ship's dying manifold, Call activated the Vox's deck speakers, adding a roar of angry static to the clamour of alarms and whoops of pained machinery.
"Right. That's got something. Mechanica monitor,"
Call cursed under his breath, and began again.
"Adeptus Mechanicus Monitor Archaeus, cease fire! We are refugees from the Trisolian Extraction Facility Momus, designation Phi-9120, Segmentum Solar. We are fleeing the forces of the Warmaster. We are loyal members of the Machine Cult, pledged to Mars and Terra. We request mercy!"
The tone of the Vox changed, and a blip broke the sound, leading them to believe just for a moment that an answer was forthcoming. But then the blip turned to a rising warble of high-energy interference.
"Their induction coils are powering to fire!" shouted Friedrich.
"I can tell!" Call snapped. "I can hear it!"
The ship was engulfed in a wash of plasma, as blue-white as the brightest star. The ocular shield slammed shut in response, but the screen and Tri-D displays conveyed enough of the glare to make the adepts wince before they gave out in showers of sparks and crackling bangs. Metal groaned. Call blinked painful afterimages away. He was unable to see which bits of the Silencia had stopped working as a result of the hit. Nothing but nonsense data poured into his memcore from the vessel's frazzled cogitators. Sparks burst in a spectacular fan from Call's console.
"I don't like it!"
Friedrich threw up his hands to protect himself, banging his wrist hard on the substandard augmetic embedded in his face, and staggering about the bucking bridge.
"Ow!"
he wailed as his data tether yanked loose.
"I hate to rebuke you, dear Friedrich, but there are very few people in this galaxy who do enjoy being fired at."
"We're going to die!"
said Friedrich. The backs of his knees connected with a chair, and he folded into it heavily. He clasped his hands together in prayer.
"Oh, Omnissiah, prepare me to enter the annals of the great work. Prepare my knowledge to..."
His eyes flew open.
"Oh, no, my records, my work. It was all on station. My life's work, it's gone."
"What life's work? You never did anything, and I've barely begun,"
Call responded incredulously.
"I had," bawled Friedrich, "some startling insights."
"Relax, it'll all be fine,"
snapped Call so sharply it was clear to them both that he did not believe a word he said. He forced the oculus back open.
It won't,
Friedrich looked out of the oculus. Look! The ship's sole void shield was going out. A final hit felled it with a flash of purple light. A feeble buzz on the Vox accompanied its collapse.
It's over, said Friedrich. We're dead.
There is always a way out, said Kaul fiercely,
a tenet he had lived his life by, only this time he was not so sure. Red lights flashed over the Silencia's bridge in such profusion they dazzled him. Three sharp whoops informed them the navigator had boarded his Salvator pod and ejected. To add to the insult, the pod overflew the dying ship, engines burning, as it fled unmolested to a safe distance, a broadcast of navigatorial cant and protestations of neutrality keeping it safe from attack.
That's charming, said Kaul. Utterly charming.
This is your fault.
You came along with me.
I had no choice.
Yes, you did.
I didn't. Be aware, Belisarius Kaul, that although you are my dearest friend, I have always hated you,
spat Friedrich. Something hit the hull, almost gently, after the shield-killing storm of plasma. A whole host of new alarms added fresh layers to the orchestra of disaster playing around the bridge. The biggest, loudest alarm warned of a plasma leak. Friedrich cringed.
The reactor is breached. This is it. Goodbye.
I don't think so, said Kaul.
He peered at a display and added with rising excitement,
I don't think so at all.
The force of the leak bursting from the side of the small vessel sent the Silencia into a lazy corkscrew.
That was a pinpoint strike, he said. A disabling hit. They don't want us dead.
The ship suddenly juddered to a halt.
As I thought. Now they have us in a grapple beam, he said, with relief. We're going to be boarded.
That's good, shrieked Friedrich. How by the three-in-one's most holy emissions can that be good?
The ship wobbled under the gravity wake of the larger vessel. A shadow fell over them. Several booming clangs rang the hull, loud as a gong.
Well, it is better than atomization, I'd say, said Kaul. Yes? Come, come, Friedrich. Better, yes?
His spirits were rising again. He was sure they'd be saved.
How I detest you, Belisarius, wailed Friedrich.
The ship's erratic progress was arrested. Further clangs boomed from the hull. The ship lurched to a stop. The alarms ceased their clamoring. Silence fell. Sparks pattered upon the floor.
What now? Breathed Friedrich. We're going to die.
They'll be here in a moment, said Kaul. Through that door.
Yes,
said Friedrich, calming a little.
Yes.
He looked down at his dishevelled garments.
By the Omnissiah, they can't see me like this.
The tech priest stood. Kaul withdrew his input dendrites from the console ports, while Friedrich fussed over his clothes. A collection of disconcerting noises came from the other side of the bridge door.
Now, they'll only be low-grade Navatoi crew, said Kaul. If we present ourselves as the adepts that we are, well,
he paused,
that I am, then we should be fine. They're only Basilicon Astromenials. Oh, shut up, Kaul, said Friedrich. What experience do you have with a Navatoi? I'd say none, none, that's what. Let me handle this for once.
Friedrich smoothed his robes down a final time, thrust his hands deep into the sleeves, and stood tall. A bang made them flinch. A small gap opened up in the middle of the bridge doors. A pair of right-angled pry bars rattled into the smoking hole, jerking about until they had a firm grip on the metal and locked tight. High-powered pressure pistons wheezed, wrenching the doorway open. Three Adeptus Mechanicus cyborgs outfitted for void warfare and clad in the blood orange of Forge World Riser marched into the command deck. All three bore low-yield plasma carbines, which could be discharged more or less safely aboard a starship. The Navatos Alpha, his status clear from his unit markings and lateral crest, had his gun shouldered and instead carried in his steel hand a small device with a wide funnel. Past the warriors, Kaul glimpsed the grievous damage done to their stolen vessel, and felt sorrow for the Silencia had been a very fine ship.
"Get on with it, then, Friedisch," whispered Kaul. "You wanted to talk to them."
Friedisch drew in a deep breath.
"Greeting, Navatoi of the Adeptus Mechanicus," he intoned. "I am Tech Acolytum Friedisch Adam Silip Quo of..."
"Targets acquired,"
blurted the Navatos Alpha in rapid Beinharic. Cone of pale blue energy burst from the device in his hand. It struck both tech priests simultaneously. Friedisch let out a girlish shriek and tapped out the dance of an electrocuted man before falling down hard onto the deck, his body stiff as a rod. Curls of smoke wisped from his augmetic. He let out a pained groan.
"Target one, subdued," said the Navatos Alpha.
The Navatoi turned questioning gazes of ruby armadlass upon Kaul.
"Hello,"
Kaul said. The leader depressed the trigger on his funnel device again. Blue light hit Kaul a second time. Nothing happened. Kaul looked down at himself, then up at them. He smiled apologetically.
"I'm afraid your override won't work on me. You see, non-standard Memcore detected, illegal modification, dark mechanicum technology, blasphemy,"
the Navatos Alpha code blurted.
"No, no, no. It's all perfectly within the law," said Kaul, holding up his hands.
A scanning beam flicked up and down Kaul.
"Single weapon detected. Sidearm. Threat negligible."
The Alpha took three clanking steps forwards, holstering the device as he came.
"This weapon is a Volkite, I'll have you know," said Kaul, offended on behalf of his weapon spirit. "Stand back. I'm not afraid to use it." "This unit refers to the bearer, not the weapon," cantered the Alpha. "My friend, please, if you would just let me explain," said Kaul.
"Negatory,"
said the Alpha, aloud this time, in a voice like the churning of a rockcrete mixer.
"Target Memcore, non-responsive to obedience protocols. Physical neutralization required."
With that, he drove the butt of his carbine hard into Kaul's face. Kaul's nose broke with a crunch, and he went down like a sack full of bolts. The Actuary Judicium was not much to look at, but held Kaul's fate in its various mechanical pseudo-hands. It was a brain in a cylinder of faintly luminous fluid that rose up from the desk when activated and slid back inside when its business was concluded. Nothing that possessed charisma, even in the odd reality of the cult. Kaul had no idea if it lived in the office permanently, wedded to its job, or if it had access to some sort of chassis that could carry it about on other business. He had no idea either what sex it had once possessed. Such beings were so far past gender it hardly mattered, but he found himself fascinated by the question. During every session the Actuary had with Kaul, Kaul speculated on the matter to stave off the worst of his boredom. There wasn't much else he could do. They chained him to the chair in the interview room. He couldn't even pace about. It didn't take much to restrain him. He was mostly human, and only a couple of manacles were required to hold him in place. 8 socket ports ringed the Actuary's upper assembly, where, under a smooth ring of metal that matched the desktop, various life-supporting machineries were concentrated. From 7 of the ports, long, banded metal data tethers connected the Actuary to a flock of servo skulls that whooped and buzzed and darted about, staring at Kaul with cold glass eyes and taking it in turns to probe at him on every wavelength. The 8th port was sealed over with a riveted cap that loudly proclaimed it inactive. This had been done for entirely obvious reasons. 8 was an unpopular number after the Great Heresy War, it being held sacred by the apostates of the Dark Mechanicum. Any whiff of treachery was to be avoided. And that was precisely why Kaul was in so much trouble. The Actuary's nerves hung from the stubby remains of its spinal column in root-like profusion, each delicately linked to a golden wire. Disturbingly, despite its headlong desire to purge itself of all flesh, the Actuary had opted to retain its startlingly green eyes, which floated in the suspension liquid moored to the foreparts of the brain by carefully preserved optic nerves. Tiny ducted propellers had been attached to the bloodshot whites to enable the eyes to keep station and look about. It was an unsuccessful augmentation, for the eyes floated in the fluid not quite level with one another. Kaul found them completely repulsive to look at, But he did his best to keep his nerve and hold the actuary's necessarily unblinking stare.
Subject 3199876,
the actuary blared. A servo skull fitted with a voxmeter spoke for it. The language processor was harsh and the speaker poorly modulated. Call's cell was a silent space of white noise and EM waves, intended to block every kind of data projection from the human voice to laser pulse. He would have found the actuary's voice grating under normal circumstances, but after his lengthy and forced meditations, it was unbearable.
Data has come to light regarding your claim of innocence. It is not a claim, said Call irritably. It is a fact.
He tried hard to keep his eyes on the floating orbs in the tank, but their unevenness made it a task that bred headaches.
Do you recognize this?